views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is me, your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those checking this out for the very first time, I say thank you. Today's episode, I have the CEO, Greg Zelver. Greg is the CEO of Westwood International. It is an internationally acclaimed leadership consulting firm. Greg and I have some very interesting, he's very stoic, passionate about what he does. Passionate about being from Wisconsin, passionate about being a Green Bay Packers fan. I can tell I've had a lot of coffee today. Also, today's episode is brought to you by C-Suite Network. C-Suite Radio is my content partner as well as Transformation Radio. I'm on their Conscious Business channel. So, listen, y'all, stay tuned today. Today's episode, CEO Greg Zelver of Westwood International. As always, leave a review on iTunes. Reach out and talk to me, touch me, speak to me, whatever you want to do. Have a great week, everybody. And wait and look for the bonus episode. See you.
I am doing well, thank you. And yourself?
Good, thanks. I was reading a little bit about you, and one of your passions is helping children around the world. And so I was watching this video. what a great way to start a podcast, really. I was watching a video of women in Hyderabad, India, girls who get sold to old men at like 12 and then are repeatedly raped. And And I was just like, all right, well, what a great way to start a podcast thinking about this. So I was like,
oh my God.
Yeah.
That's awful.
So what got you into that? I mean, I know your background is pastoral care. I know that's one of your degrees. Is that kind of what drives you?
Yeah. No, I think the, so have we started the interview? Is this the start of the interview right now?
Yeah. Let's just start chatting. Let's do this.
All right, great. Okay. So the thing that drives me, I mean, that's a great question in and of itself, which is probably a different question or would have a different answer. But in terms of young people, I started out as a high school science teacher. I went to college for biology. I have a degree in biology, and I intended to go to medical school. And then while I was in college, I realized I was reading books on psychology and personal development, you know, like Merton and Teilhard de Chardin, Scott Peck, you know, these are the people I was reading. It wasn't medical. And so I decided to pivot, keep my science degree, but then move towards more the mind and the spirit than the body. And so I finished my college career with a biology degree, and then kind of by a stroke of luck, ended up teaching in a local high school.
Because you went to Boston, right? Boston U.
I went to Boston College for graduate school.
Okay.
For undergraduate, I went to Lawrence University from Wisconsin. Yeah. Yeah. So I went to Lawrence in Appleton And then when I graduate, end up teaching for 4 years at Xavier High School, which was, you know, I mean, first of all, the first year was the toughest job I've ever had, even to this day. But it was a great experience. Wonderful students, you know, wonderful family and community. And it was great to be a part of it.
I would have thought that being that that's a Catholic school, the kids would have been well-behaved and on point. No?
Oh, no, the kids weren't the problem. It was me. Because I had no idea what I was doing. And I was totally stumped. And so what happened was, you know, I got there and I didn't have much money. That first contract was $12,500 for me for that first year of teaching. Yeah. I mean, even to this day, I can't believe I made it on that amount. But the way I did it is I bought a used car and I saved up a little money in college, bought a used car, and I was a counselor at a place called ABC House, which is a Better Chance. And it brings in inner city students from around the country who are good students and wanted to get a second chance in the better school system. So it was a nonprofit organization. We housed like 12 to 15 kids. And I was there with two other counselors. And I lived at that, at the ABC House at night and on the weekends, and then went and talked during the day. Mm. And I literally went from, you know, being a college student to all of a sudden having a full-time job and being responsible for 12 to 15 teenagers every night. And it was totally overwhelming. I mean, I literally was just trying to go from minute to minute. Like, what do I have to get done the next minute, the next minute, the next minute? And I was in April, I don't know, March or April, I was totally exhausted in the teacher's lounge. And I had my head down on the table, and the German teacher, Jim Beckley, walked in. And he says, "Greg?" And I look up, and I'm like, "Yeah." And he says, "Exhausted?" And I'm like, "Oh, Jim, I am so tired." He said, "You know why you're so tired?" And I was like, "No, why?" He said, "You've got it all wrong." I'm like, "What do I have wrong, Jim?" He said, "You're trying to be good your first year. Your first year of teaching, all you have to do is survive."
Yeah.
And I kind of looked at the calendar, and I'm like, "Wait a minute, it's like March, April." I'm like, "I've survived most of the year. I can make it to the end."
Yeah. And more importantly, you were like, "Where was that advice in September when I started?"
Yeah. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
I mean, some of the best advice we get, though, is when we're in deep pain because we can really hear it then. Or, you know, like the best meals we eat are the ones when we're really hungry. So, you know, I was, needless to say, I was really hungry at that point. So it was great. It was great advice. And I made it through that year and then, you know, stayed for three more years. You know, Wow. Kind of got the hang of it a little bit and stayed for three more years and had a great experience there teaching and doing the work. So
and you were just doing science there. You were a science teacher.
Yeah, it was biology, general science, and earth science.
Do you still use that today?
So I taught. Well, the biology I do. Because what's fascinating to me, so then I finished this little backstory. I finished teaching, but while I was teaching, I still wanted to go to graduate school, even though medical school I decided wasn't for me. I still wanted to go to graduate school. So I started thinking about what's most important to me. And to me, the most important thing was my spirituality. And I had no commercial, like, incentive to do a spirituality. I mean, that's the least commercially incentive there is, right? You get nothing for that.
Yeah. I think that's called purpose having purpose and being noble, not being capitalistic, really, when you go that route.
Yeah, or foolish, whatever. Yeah. It's one of those somewhere in the category. So I went to summer school for one or two summer sessions because it would be a little easier to handle. And then I decided to go full-time for a year to finish the degree.
And that was Boston College. Yeah.
That was Boston College.
Can we back up a little bit, though? So where did you grow up originally?
So I grew up in Wisconsin.
So you're
born in Milwaukee. Yeah.
So then you clearly are like, are you a Green Bay Packers fan? Like you have to be.
Well, fan might not be strong enough of a word. It's more like a religion.
Okay. All right. I was going to be like, I felt like you were getting ready to do some sort of sacrilegious thing right there when you were going to tell me no. So, okay, I feel better about that. Go ahead.
You were right on with that. Yeah.
So what was it like growing up in Wisconsin? Because Wisconsin's beautiful. It's a beautiful state. Like, did you grow up in a big family? Because I know you've mentioned spirituality and you taught Xavier. So, you know, I went to University of Dayton and I married a Notre Damer. So, you know, Catholicism is kind of there. And Xavier, to me, screams Catholicism. So, like, were you raised in a Catholic family?
I was raised in a Catholic family. Grew up 2 blocks from my grade school, which was Holy Name Grade School, and 2 blocks from my high school, which was St. Catherine's. And our mascot was the Angels. And then went to Lawrence University and then on to Boston College. So, yeah, I was raised very Catholic.
Did you grow up in a big family?
Well, yes and no. I'm the oldest of 4 boys. But since we live 2 blocks from the grade school, 2 blocks from the high school, my brothers and I are very close in age. Matter of fact, 3 of us were in the high school at the same time, and 4 of us were in the grade school at the same time. And my father was a candy salesman, and we always had candy at our house.
Wait. He was a what salesman?
A candy salesman. Confectionery. Actually, the fancy name is confectionery broker.
Yeah. I like the broker part by the end, because it kind of sounds a little seedy, like it's a way to like dress it up a little bit. But the broker part to me sounds a bit seedy. So,
yeah, but I tell you what wasn't seedy, James, is when we got to go to the statewide candy convention every year and came out with big boxes of free candy. There was nothing seedy about that. It was like heaven. And so my dad, when he brought home candy, he brought home cases of candy.
So I would imagine when you had that would be the week of school, like you were the coolest kid in school, you and your brothers.
Oh, it wasn't the week. That was all year round. Like every week he brought that. And so kids were always, we had 2 big drawers in our kitchen that were always just full of candy. And the neighbor would always come in and say, what's in the candy drawer this week? What's in the candy drawer this week? So it was, college, sugar. They're going to put me through college.
And so did your parents stay married? Are they still married or were they married?
Oh, yeah. So still married. They're now in their 80s and doing well.
That's awesome.
Still doing well.
So, sometimes in these podcasts, it's interesting. So the people that I tend to interview from the Midwest, they have a very boring backstory because everyone was happy and healthy and parents were like great parents and I'm mocking functionality really versus the dysfunctional family. it sounds like yours is just a very normal like upbringing.
I have to say, and actually I have to correct you, my parents are in their 70s, not 80s. I don't even know why I said that. It was a very normal upbringing for me. And I think probably for like a lot of us, when you're brought up as a kid, you think what you're going through is normal, even if it isn't, or if you later find out it isn't. And for me, the whole neighborhood was always at our house and it was always a lot of fun. So there were always activities, sports. My dad built a slab in our backyard for a 2.5-car garage and he couldn't afford to build the garage after he put the slab down. So he decided to put up a basketball hoop for a year so we can enjoy it. Well, we all played so much basketball that we never allowed him to put the garage up. And that was like 10, 15 years of just the whole, like kids from all over the city coming to our place to play 3-on-3 basketball.
That's awesome.
And so, it was really neat. And so we grew up 2 blocks from Lake Michigan. So Lake Michigan was 2 blocks to the east. The grade school was 2 blocks to the west, and the high school was 2 blocks to the north.
It's almost
as if it was just such a perfect location. Yeah.
I was going to say, it's almost as if you never really had to leave. So do you still go back often?
No. Well, I just was back recently and my folks have since sold that house and they still live in Racine. And I have another brother who lives in Racine, and then my 2 other brothers live up near Appleton, Wisconsin. So I do get back fairly regularly. I got back for a Packer game this fall. And then went back for some other family stuff and hoping to go back this summer again. So, you know, this past year I've gotten back a fair amount.
That's awesome. Because you're based out of Vermont, correct?
Correct. I'm in Vermont right now. Yeah.
So, yeah. So not to jump, you know, I'll jump all around, but so why not set the company up in Wisconsin? Like why Vermont?
Yeah. So came out to Boston College. After I finished my degree at BC, they asked me to stay on as a chaplain. Actually, they asked me to interview for the position. I interviewed and got the job, and I stayed 7 years as a chaplain at Boston College.
What was that like?
And, oh, it was the best job I ever had. Because it's kind of interesting. So I had a boss who was so hands-off. He literally, like the week I started, he put my job description in my mailbox. Didn't talk to me, I just put it in my mailbox. And I pulled it out and I looked at him like, this is overwhelming. And I sat with it for like 2 days thinking, how am I going to do all this? And I went to the chaplain who had the office next to me. And I said, you know, Carrie, how am I going to do all this? This list is unbelievable. And she's like, Greg, that's not your job description. I was like, what is that? She said, that's a description of what the whole department does. I'm like, oh, well, I'm like, what am I supposed to do? She says, you can just make it up. Just, you got to do this and this, and then the rest of it, you can make it up. And so it was funny because I noticed on a lot of the chaplain's doors, they would always close the door and put a little sign like in session or on the phone or counseling or design or whatever. So I didn't have anything to do. So I made up like 3 or 4 little signs and I would just rotate them during the day. And I'm sitting in the office. I'm thinking, what the heck am I going to do? And I realized I just got to do something that I want to do. And I thought, you know, I want to run retreats and experiences for students. And I thought they all like skiing. So I started this thing called Ski Retreats. And it just kind of built some momentum. And then I found some students who want to do more youth ministry and learn more about leadership. And I had paid my way through graduate school by working as a youth minister in some parishes that year I was in graduate school. Actually, did it for a couple of years. And so I started training students on how to do youth ministry. And I built this whole leadership program called the Salt and Light Company. And then the time I got connected with Dr. M. Scott Peck, and was certified to run community building workshops. So I started a floor on Boston College called Community Living Floor. And by the time I was finished, I was working with like hundreds of students and it was so much fun. I mean, it was a blast. But the first 3 months, I just had to figure it out myself. There was no one telling me anything. So, and, I mean, to the point where like my job performance review at the end of the year was just a note in my mailbox that said, please sign this.
So what was it about working with these various students that charged you, that jazzed you up? Because clearly spirituality is like at the center of all of this. So clearly, I mean, did you identify as Catholic or just spiritual at that point?
Well, I identify as Catholic, but I would say now I'm probably a closet Buddhist.
Hmm.
In the sense that I'm a very liberal Catholic and that I think everyone's got a place on the planet. And I say closet Buddhist because what intrigues me so much about Buddhism is their commitment to building skills of compassion and the tools and practices that they have put into place that people can practice to make that happen. And I heard it described that the difference between Buddhists and Christians is that Christians have a hand to hold. And that Buddhists don't. They have to depend on themselves. And so for me personally, marrying those practices from Buddhism, which really push the individual to develop themselves to be as compassionate as possible, to me is the most responsible I can be as a Christian versus just saying, Jesus, help me, Jesus, help me, Jesus, help me.
Yeah. Because, you know, to me, it sounds very Jesuit-esque though, right? So compassion is one of the major pillars of a Jesuit.
So isn't that kind of ingrained?
Yeah, let's hope it's a major film for most Christians.
Well, true. Fair. Fair.
Yeah.
Fair. I think hypocrisy is usually the following one. I'm just kidding. That sounds so cynical. Sorry.
I mean, that's human nature, though, right? You know, it's you get into a club and you want to keep everyone else out. That's what can happen sometimes. So.
Yeah. It's a bit of a mess.
It's unfortunate.
A bit of a quagmire in the U.S. currently in that capacity. So.
It totally is. Totally.
So what made you leave then? I mean, you have this job, you've gained a huge following, you have this massive impact. Like, what was driving you to leave that?
Well, at the time I had two kids and I was doing this work with M. Scott Peck, and we were doing community building workshops, myself and him and his foundation. And I got offers from three different companies to be put on retainer to work with teams within their organizations. And it was pretty significant. And so I went to my boss and I said, look, I can run all of my programs half-time. I mean, the program's full-time, but I only have to be half-time because at this point, I developed so many different student leaders and interns and things to run things that I really pushed the students to lead themselves. And I had them in a 2-3 year program, but by the time they get to the third or fourth year, they could run their own teams or run the meetings or run the pieces. And I'd also developed an internship program. So there are interns who could be helping and running things as well. So I said, look, you let me run these programs full time, be here half time. You just pay me half the amount. You give me half salary and full benefits, and we'll do it. And my boss was like, oh, that's a great deal, right? You're going to run all your programs full time, but you only be here half time, and you only give you half. Because I needed the time off to run these other things that the companies were asking me to.
Yeah.
And it went all the way up to the university president. And the university president said, no, he's either here full time or he's not.
Mm.
And so I resigned. And looking back on it, it was the right thing. I mean, it was hard to leave that job because I loved it so much, but it was right for me to move into what I was moving into. And, you know, from a financial family perspective, it was the right thing.
Was that one of those fork in the road moments where if I go right, my life is this, if I go left, my life is this?
Yeah. I don't know what the left would have taken me, like where it would have taken me.
Mm-hmm.
But the right was definitely a fork in the road. And since then, it's been a very different life.
So you left. And is that when Westwood Internationals was born?
Yeah, it was born while I was still a chaplain at Boston College because, you know, companies did ask me to do workshops here and there. So I started my own company while I was still on staff at BC and started doing workshops. And then, you know, after 2 or 3 years of doing the workshops, I had those companies that I mentioned earlier call me and say, look, we want to put you on retainer. And that's when I had to make a big decision. And that was the fork in the road. So, yeah, so I started the company while I was at Boston College.
And can I ask how you got the name Westwood International?
Yeah, it's a couple things. One, I was living in Westwood, Massachusetts at the time.
Okay.
Two, I wanted a company that wasn't my name, something I could grow into. And three, it had the initials of WY, which was Wisconsin, which I absolutely love. So it worked out very well.
So at first I'm thinking, all right, not very original, but now you got the WI in there. I get it. Now I get the originality of why you selected what you did.
Yeah.
So what was the first few years like as you're doing this? Cause you're a sole proprietor at this point.
Correct. It was interesting. I mean, the first few times out of the gate, I literally had people steal from me in the sense that, you know, people who had their own firms saw that I was good at designing and running events and experiences for teams and groups. And so they said, look, can you come in and design this or design that or put this 2-day format or a 3-day experience together? And I said, yeah, you know, I'm happy to do that, but what's the compensation? And one gentleman said, look, I'll make you a partner in the firm. You know, if you can do this and this and get this going, I'll make you a partner. You know, I'm sure it wouldn't have been a full partner, but some kind of ownership. And I said, great, you'll give me ownership. I'll do this design work and start developing this. So 6 months into it, I'm like, okay, where's the ownership? 12 months, 18 months. Finally, he said, there's going to be no ownership. And I was like, wait, that was, you know, that was our deal. And, you know, so that was one situation. Another situation, I was just trying to get started to learn how to do more of some corporate strategic work. And there was a person I knew was very good at that. And, they said, look, I'll bring you, but I can't pay you a lot. I'm like, that's fine. I'll help. You know, I'm an assistant. And so I finally go and do the work and they're like, well, you know, there's really not that much money, so I'm not going to be able to pay you. I'm like, that's fine. So I turn in my expenses and they're like, oh, we're not going to be able to pay your expenses either. I'm like, wait a minute. You know, so I finally just said, I've got to do this myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just had to go and do it myself. And so I did. And it was pretty funny. I set up this conference, Community Building and Organizations Conference. And essentially what it was, is I was doing community building workshops with Dr. Peck and these group dynamics workshops. But it also had great implication for intact teams. And so I created this experience where groups could come together, have an experience of a community building workshop, and then spend a day or two talking about, here are some other tools and ways you can bring this into your organization where it can make an impact. So I designed this conference and marketed it myself. Well, about 10 days before the conference, I had 8 people signed up and I am losing my shirt. And my wife was like, what the heck are you doing? Cancel it, cancel it, cancel it. And I'm like, no, I can't. This like my, I've got to make this work. She's like, it's costing us money. We're losing our shirt. You can't make it work. So I called every person who signed up. And I said, look, you know, I expect to have 20, 30 people signed up. You only have 7. Here's how it'll change the experience. I'm giving you the option if you want to, you know, have a full refund right now, if you want to go with it. And every single person said, I want to go with them.
Huh.
And lo and behold, in that next 10 days, I had 7 or 8 more people sign up. So I ended up with like 15 or 16 people at the experience. And in the experience was a superintendent of schools that said, look, you got to bring this into my schools. And there was another person who was an affiliate for a consulting company that said, look, we really need people like you in our company. And I got 2 great leads that led to other opportunities from that workshop.
Isn't that just that experience?
And so it was like by a thread. Yeah, made it by a thread.
I was going to ask you something, though. When these people are stiffing you and not paying you, do you ever wonder how they put their head on their pillow at night?
No, I don't.
Oh.
I don't, because I've seen it now so often, and I see human shortcomings so often that it's part of the planet.
Does that depress you?
For us, not at all. No, it actually has helped me be more compassionate.
Yeah.
It's helped me be more open and honest and compassionate. You know, like I've just been through a difficult thing this week where I had a contractual agreement with someone. You know, they agreed to give some things back to me and, you know, at the last minute said, no, I'm not giving those things back. I threw them out. They're not available. So I thought, you know, okay, I get it. You're not going to follow through on the spirit. Then I'm just going to follow the letter of the law too. And so I followed the letter of the law of the contract. And on Wednesday, when the final exchange happened, the other party was really upset. They're like, I expected this, this, and this. And I said, yeah, well, and I expected my things to be returned. And the person said, then the deal's off. And I turned to my lawyer. I'm like, the deal can't be off. We already have the deal. And he said, the deal can't be off. It's already signed. And now we're just going to execute the letter on paper. And so, you know, all parties were forced just to execute what happened, what we had agreed to. But I can say it was really unfortunate. And it was interesting because, you know, I certainly had parts and roles in the whole experience getting to that point. I didn't consider myself fully innocent. And yet at this point, where it was really clear the other party wasn't following, was just taking advantage everywhere they could.
Yeah. There was,
and then
no,
when finally they were really upset and felt totally justified. And it didn't depress me at all. A matter of fact, I thought, that's human nature right there. We think what we're doing is perfectly okay, and if the other party is wrong, even as obvious as it may be to the other side and to the rest of the world. And so,
wait, like, can I stop you right there, though?
Sure.
So I think that's a great example, because it just gets me thinking about you know, use the word human nature, and obviously we're all fallible. Like, there's no, you can't argue that.
There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm reminded by my children and my wife on a regular basis, so I totally know it's true. But I don't know. Like, I feel like that's the one thing. So I guess I had two questions. Like, did you learn to be more, like, would you define yourself as a people pleaser or a rule follower? Or can you be both, I guess?
I used to be very much a people pleaser.
And what changed over time?
Is I realized that I wasn't the best for the world while I was trying to please people. I was actually, in my attempts to try to please people, was making the world worse.
How? Like, can you elaborate on that?
Take an example. So I put together teams that go out and do leadership development and run leadership development programs for companies. And there have been people who have come to me and saying, look, I want to do this and that. And I could see they needed a break. And they might not have been a perfect fit, but they could do a good job at the right price for a client. So I would try to find a role for them or a way they could help or a way they could get developed while the client was still being served. And there were times where I would let people do some things they weren't really ready to do yet, even though they wanted to do it. And there are also times with clients where clients say, no, I want this, this, and this. And I know that's not right for them. But I'll try to please them and try to meet their needs while trying to find a way to get what they needed, even though they didn't know they needed it. And as I look back on that, the inability to be more and more discerning and clear about what works and what doesn't work and what's right and what's not right, even though there's no such thing as right and not right. I don't think it's that clean.
Yeah.
But between my experience and intuition, I get a sense of what really is going to work and isn't. And not standing up for that and being clear about it, that has created as much pain and difficulty, if not more, in the long run.
So is that...
And I would be better off doing that instead of trying to please people.
So, yeah. So to me then, like, was that... Because the pleasing obviously leads to, I don't want to disappoint, and I don't want them to think ill of me. And so what you're doing is you don't actually have their best interest in mind because you don't want to upset them. So you're more worried about have the fear of upsetting someone versus telling them the hard truths.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Or having a difficulty or tension in a relationship instead of doing what is really best. You know, like I was in a recent relationship where my spirituality was, you know, ridiculed, subtly, but ridiculed and certainly not supported. And so I gave up parts of it, you know, so it wouldn't cause tension. And as I'm looking back on it, trying to please was really not doing a service to the world. Mm-hmm. And I could have stood up for myself in a more compassionate and clear way. It still would have allowed the other people to have saved their face and their opinion and what they want to do, and me still do what I need to do.
I think that's fascinating.
And part of my growth is learning to be more and more mature in that realm.
Well, for me, I hear that. I mean, I'm totally on the same boat where I feel like, but I usually have a different frame of reference where, and maybe it's just masking it, right? Like we put layers of emotion and rationality behind choices that we make. So, you know, I see myself outside my family being willing to say, I don't care, or that's just fine. Because I kind of feel like if I don't have a strong opinion about something, I don't mind being flexible in the moment. Even if I have a preference, even if I have a preference, right? I have a preference, but I like, there's no need to rock the boat here. There's no need to be that guy. There's no need to be, or gal, you know, so I mean, I can totally relate to it on so many different things where I've just kind of said, whatever, you know, and what I'm trying to do now is like, I'm starting a consulting practice here and I'm really trying to be very clear about when it comes to decisions, at least. This is what I'm doing. Like, I'm very clear with my vision, what I want, but it's that human interaction where I always go, whatever works best for you, I don't care. Even if it kind of bothers me, they don't do it the way I want to do it. But that could be like 12 other reasons. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a control freak, or I think I know what's best, or whatever. But yeah, I could see that. I could see your point wholeheartedly and relate to it 1,000%.
Yeah. And I think here's the place where discernment and insight gets really tricky is, you know, if someone wants to do something that I don't want them to do, but I go along with it, at what point do I need to step in and say, no, I want to do it this way and for this reason? Or if it really isn't important to me, I just let it go. Because that's give and take in relationship as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how to be in that zone or in that place to be able to make those decisions just calmly and peacefully, almost in some ways, and keep moving forward and not get caught in a dysfunctional pattern one way or the other, either being too demanding or controlling or too judgmental or giving up too much and not taking responsibility. I think I see very few people who can do that well. I'm not one of them. And it's people who can do that well, I think, are real giants.
Do you have an example of someone that you think does that well?
Yeah, there's a few people in my life who I can say they do that really well, and I use them as models or examples. Like, I have one of my best friends, probably my best friend. You know, I'll say, Paul, let's go do this, let's go do that. And you're like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm like, what do you mean you're not going to do that? Just come. He's like, no, I don't want to, and here's why. Da, 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 da. And I'll try to cajole him, push him, get him. He's like, you know, no, I'm not doing that. And I'd be like, hey, he's so clear and clean about that. And, you know, like just today I asked someone to go do this kind of weekend experience for business. And they're like, no, I don't want to do that. I'm like, what do you mean? You said no before you even knew it. I said, no, in my heart, I know it's not right. And I've got these other things going on. I've got to protect my time. Yeah. I'm like, well, at least consider it. And they're like, no, it's not right for me. It's okay for you. If you want to do it, go do it. I fully support you and I'll support you in this way and that way, but it's not for me.
I literally did that yesterday with someone, like, where I could tell there was an ask in there. So, you know, living in the Middle East, it's a unique place. People don't mind asking you to do stuff. I mean, they have no problem, whatever. And if you don't say no, they literally will just keep chewing around the edges until you're done. And so, This guy came up to me that I work with, and he goes, you know, I took your advice and I really like the idea. I started a podcast, and he goes, you know, but it just takes so much time and energy. And I got all these things. And I go, is there an ask in there? And he's like, yeah, sort of. And I said, well, I'm going to stop you. I'm doing these five things. I think it's awesome what you're doing. Go do it. And if you want to sit down for a half hour and do strategy, great, let's do it. If you want to sit down for 45 minutes to talk about X, let's do it. But I cannot commit to anything beyond what I'm possibly doing right now, because I will lose my head and I'll do everything bad and nothing well. And the guy was great. He's like, mm-hmm. I really appreciate your honesty on that and not just saying yes. And I think that's a lesson right. We all can learn, is that be self-aware enough to know where your limits are and how to say no, and do it in a way that's not offensive, but in a way that says, listen, I appreciate what you're doing and what you're trying to accomplish. I just can't be part of that process right now. Maybe in a year, maybe in 2 years, but at the moment, it's just not in the cards.
Right, exactly.
But why do you think it's so hard for people?
Well, because then there's those times where you've got to say yes, even when it's not right, because it's going to stretch you and make you a better person.
Mm.
And how do you know when to do it when that one is coming around?
Yeah. Damn it.
You know, so it's yeah. I like that. Damn it, you. So it's always, to me, a discernment process. But I do think we can get better and better. Like I think the needle can point clearer and clearer as we move forward. And I feel like that's happened for me.
Do you think that's wisdom? Yeah. Like that's what wisdom is, right?
I would totally say that. Yeah.
Yeah. So what I want to do, because I could talk to you about this stuff forever, but I want to respect your time. We're going to do a segment called Fast Five, five random questions.
Okay.
No need to go fast. Just talk like we're doing. Just there's an actual question involved. And then we'll actually want to talk about Westwood International, kind of what you're doing there, the direction you're kind of going, and see where that takes us. So you ready to play Fast Five?
I am.
Go. All right. Question one. First job ever.
First job ever. Well, I came home eighth grade. I'm sitting down. I think I was watching the cartoon Speed Racer at the time. It was a great cartoon. And my dad pulls up and he says, get in the car. I'm like, whoa, why? He's like, I got to take you somewhere. And so he drives me to a restaurant. It turns out one of his best friends is starting a restaurant. And he says, you're working here now. I'm like, what? And I ended up in the kitchen working with a woman named Seal who like ripped me a new one every day. And that was my first job. And it was a great experience, but boy, it was total baptism by fire. That was my first working at Le Coco's restaurant in Racine, Wisconsin.
That is awesome. All right. Question two.
Yeah.
What advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
Boy, there's a lot of advice there.
If you could pick one, that would be potentially most impactful.
Yeah. Stay true to yourself. You know, just listen to what you do. Yeah. And just trust that. Yeah. It's going to hurt some people. Some people are going to be upset, but it's, if you know what you need to do, do it and let the rest of the world figure it out.
But, you know, and I think that...
Don't try to... Yeah.
But yeah. That's life. Like, that's what I think I figured. I'm only 42. Like, don't get me wrong. I have a shit ton left to learn. But I think that's what life teaches you. I think while you're young, you know, you're in this ocean trying to sort yourself out and where to go and what direction, how to be and who to please and who not to please and how to say no and when to say no. And, you know, you get married and you have kids and your life's this quagmire all the time. But each time there's a failure or success, it kind of goes into this bank of choices. And the more failures and successes that you have, the more wise and concrete the choices that you make. That doesn't always happen that way. It'd be great if it always did, but to stay true to yourself, that's something you have to figure out over time. It's so hard to do, you know. So, All right. My favorite question. What animal best describes your management style?
Yeah, I have no idea. But I will say I have dreams of orcas every once in a while. So in the last couple of years, people asked me a question similar to this. I would say an orca. But I have no idea what style of management they are. So,
well, they're team focused.
I do know,
right? Orcas are team based.
They're team focused.
They work in pods.
They're team based, team focused. Yeah, and they work in pods, and they're okay going in cold temperatures as well as warm. So that's my style. That's it.
All right, it's yours. Own it. Let's make sure your blowhole's not covered. All right. Question four. When you die, not to be morbid, but when you die, what do you want people to say about you at your funeral?
Yeah, that he never gave up on himself and he kept standing up and trying.
That's great. I love when people can give that answer succinct, because it's either as if you thought about it or you're living your life in that moment, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when I ask that question sometimes, it's a very long answer, which means you haven't ever been really self-reflected. In fact, one of my best answers ever, when I asked someone what advice they'd give them 25-year-old self, and this person was like late 60s, it was literally nothing about changing something or being true to yourself, or it was, oh, I would have picked this career. And I was like, really? Like nothing about self-improvement? He's like, no, nope. And I was like, huh. All right. Like, I kind of would have thought, I would have thought you would have had a little self-reflection at like 68, but all right. If not, good for you. That works. All right. Question five. What is your best trick, tool? I won't use trick, tool, to get people to work together at one of your seminars?
Yeah, best tool is showing people that what they see is not what exists. And as soon as they understand that all of this that they thought was real and exists and was the truth isn't, it opens up their mind to be open to other people's opinions and perspectives and to be able to move in more creative ways.
That's awesome. So could I follow up question on that then is, can you give an example of how you do that?
Sure. I'll give you three different examples. So, one is an exercise that I got from another consultant. And essentially, if you just take your index finger and you put a circle going clockwise in the air on facing the ceiling, so your hand's above your head, you're looking at the ceiling and you're drawing a clockwise shape on the ceiling. And then you drop your hand down to your belly button, keeping your finger still pointed at the ceiling, and look at it. And now is it going clockwise or counterclockwise?
Ah, wow. Great trick. I just did it.
It's a great trick. It's a great trick. And now we have a conversation. So if I said it was going counterclockwise and you said it was clockwise, who's right? Yeah. Now simple. Yeah. It's a great little exercise. So different experiences or exercises that can help people see that when you say something, it doesn't tell people the truth. It just tells them your perspective. And that's, you know, like those kinds of experiences really are the tools or tricks, I think, that help people.
Yeah. Because it really forces them, to your point earlier, to say, oh, it's not what I thought. And I think if you show them enough of those, it could be hit home, you know? So.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for doing Fast Five. That was it.
You're welcome.
All right. So let's spend the remainder. We have about 5 or 10 minutes left. And just quickly talk about Westwood International. You know, I mean, you have this company where you travel all over the world. But if you were to give me a 10,000 foot view of what it is you do, how would you describe it?
So for our company, because there's several of us here now at this point, it's not just me. Our focus is to design experiences for leaders and teams to help them develop their interpersonal skills and mindsets so they can be more creative and effective. And what we do is just like that little exercise I taught you there, a whole series of different exercises or experiences, usually based around a real business project and oftentimes with a team that is cross-functional or cross-global or, you know, from different companies or groups that they have to learn to work together. And I'm very fortunate now to work with a very talented group of people who can skillfully go in and coach people, guide people, and help people do that well, while at the same time developing other skills they need, like facilitating a meeting, giving a presentation, putting together an elevator pitch, becoming a better storyteller, dealing with conflict, a lot of the interpersonal skills that are needed, all around leadership and leadership development. And so what we do now is custom craft programs and experiences for leaders and teams all over the world.
So is your unique selling proposition the talent you've acquired to do these things? Because I feel like other companies probably do the same thing.
It's not just the talent. It's also the mindset and spirit that we have. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a combination of, and this is where I was just so damn lucky when I was younger that I had the biology degree and then the degree in spirituality and pastoral ministry. Because now with emotional intelligence and the science all catching up, there's a biology and a science to this whole thing of being open, listening, caring, putting the customer first, etc. In a lot of ways, the science helps us, but it's still a spiritual exercise. And it's not necessarily spiritual. I don't even have to use that word. It's an ego-expanding exercise, or it's an exercise of looking at people beyond yourself. right? And understanding there's a bigger world and a bigger picture. Like that challenge is the human challenge and is the next challenge for business. The next challenge for business is, how do we see people as people in this world that's becoming more and more personalized? Mm-hmm. How do we create relationships with people and networks of people where they trust us and we can trust them, we can build things together? And that isn't a technique question. That's a lot of ways a spiritual question and a trust question and a relationship question, which still in one way, shape, or form comes back to spirituality. Who are you in the world? How big is your world? How do you see the world?
Do you think there's a little bit of a cultural barrier, though? Like, you know, I think in the U.S. specifically, less so in maybe other countries, and you might be able to speak to this better than myself, but we tend to believe that what happens at work stays at work, and when we go home, it's a different life. And there's no really cross communicating, so there's never that instance of trust building. And so how do you build that trust and that next level of communication?
Well, I think you're also touching on some generational issues here as well, mm-hmm. because for the new generation entering the workforce, I don't think that line is as clear as it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And I'm probably one of the few people in my generation who am very excited about young people, because I think they have it right. I think they're blending more of their personal and their business. They're blending more of who they are with their vision and what they want to see in the world. And they have a more inclusive attitude and perspective, not only for other people, but also for their life and their energy. And I think the question you posed is more post-generational, and I think the other is more the new generation. And I'm looking forward to seeing how those two blend, because
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, I think what bothers me sometimes is when people label millennials as aloof or undirected or whatever. Like, does everyone forget what they were like in their 20s? Because most of us were somewhat the same. Now, I know back, you know, my generation, maybe generation before, it's you get a job, you stick with a job forever. That part has definitely changed. But those individuals' minds still wondered, still wanted for other, and they just culturally couldn't do it. Now, you know, millennials have the ability and desire to do it, but they're learning a whole other set of tools and skill sets that will actually be much more beneficial in running an organization. And I think you touched on one of the ones that is really quite impactful, is the idea of purpose. Like, so many millennials want to work for a company that has some sort of actual purpose in the world. And I credit that to a lot of universities that make that a central part of what they're trying to do with their students, to make them more well-rounded, to make them care about something other than themselves, something bigger than themselves. And, you know, the research is so clear that when you put something else before yourself, that the return you get internally is so far exceeded than what you would expect.
Yeah. And I think they are, I would say they're more purpose-driven, mm-hmm. they're more inclusive, and they're more fluid. And I think all three of those mindsets or values are going to be much more valuable and important than all those values that we developed 20, 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think they're perfectly poised to save and make a huge impact in the world. And I really hope our generation trusts them more and more, because they have it. They definitely have it.
Well, and you're an authority there. Like, you see it all the time, I'm sure. So.
Well, and I spent, you know, the first 10 years of my life working with young people. I get it. You know, I see where they're coming from. So, you know,
And I think social media has allowed them to be more vocal about their opinions, you know, in a way mm-hmm. they could never do it before. And
right.
they definitely get the validation, because everyone will like it, share it, whatever. So they get that whole very basic learning model of, I just taught this in class and I forgot. Operant learning, right? Positive reinforcement. Mm-hmm. Reinforcement. So mm-hmm. I have this idea. It's great. Like, share. Oh, that's a, you know, that's positive reinforcement. That's great. So that obviously builds their confidence as well. Well, listen, Greg,
absolutely.
You have been amazing with your time, and I appreciate it wholeheartedly. So I have one final question before I let you jet off and run your business. How do you, for where you're at in your life, how do you define happiness?
The way I see the world.
I need a little unpacking on that one. Sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, like an example. So this week was, I mean, I shared with you some of the tougher things that happened this week. And, you know, I could take it one way and I wouldn't be so happy. But when I look at it and see it like, you know what, this is a whole nother lesson. It's a whole nother experience for me. It's another way for me to grow up and to learn. And to learn to be compassionate and open to all different opinions and views and not get bitter and judgmental. I was really happy this week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all based on how I see it. And I'm not talking about making things up that aren't true, because everything I'm thinking is true. And there are 5 or 10 other perspectives that are very different from mine that are also true and that take people to different spots. What I'm realizing more and more is that the way I see the world determines my happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's totally up to me on how I see the world and how I portray things. Based on how I portray things, that determines my happiness and my performance.
Because I think it's the way you respond to things, right? So to me, it boils down to
What do you respond out of?
Yeah.
You respond out of how you see it.
Yeah. And I didn't even think, even if it's negative, all right, well, I have 2 choices, you know? So, I mean, 2 basic choices. Don't get me wrong. There's a myriad of choices. But I could be negatively impacted or positively. And how you choose to let that situation, whatever it is, you know, it's, I guess the fundamental word is it's choice. That's what I'm getting to. Well, on that note, Greg, thank you for your time, your willingness, and desire to sit down with me on Executives After Hours. I appreciate everything about you, and I could talk to you for hours probably. So thank you.
That'd be great. Well, let's do it again sometime then, James.
Awesome. Have a great day.
All right. You too. Take care. Bye-bye.